This is Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Maintaining bone strength is complex with no single solution. My patients who want to optimize their bone health have seen remarkable results with LiveMD as part of a comprehensive bone program. LiveMD is a Class 1 medical device cleared by the FDA. It creates a gentle, low-intensity vibration to benefit your musculoskeletal system. It's a safe, scientifically proven, and simple approach to maintaining musculoskeletal health and wellness. It really works, just 10 minutes per day. Go to livemd.us, that's livemd.us, to learn more about how LiveMD may improve your health. That's livemd.us.
Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. This is Layla Mutin on another issue of Layla Weighs In to answer some of your questions. And you can send your questions to radioprogram@AOL.com. I love seeing some of you are already sending me questions. Aside from the questions that you send for Dr. Hoffman and I to do on Q&A with Layla. So I really appreciate your questions. Again, it's radioprogram@AOL.com. So I've got a question from Jean. Jean writes, I noticed recently that the ingredients list on Silk Soy Milk show that carrageenan has been replaced with something called gelin gum or gelin gum. I'm going to call it gelin gum because it gels. What is that? Does it have any impact on health, good or bad? This is a wonderful, wonderful question, Jean. Thank you. First, let's talk about the carrageenan that the gelin gum has replaced. What is carrageenan? I've heard from a lot of people about carrageenan, having gastrointestinal problems and things like that. Carrageenan has been used for decades in conventional foods, in natural foods. And it was first approved for use in organics in the 1990s. Carrageenan in and of itself doesn't provide any nutritional value to processed foods. It's added as a stabilizer. It's a thickening agent or an emulsifier to make a finished product that improves what food technologists call mouthfeel. Okay. What carrageenan is, it's an indigestible polysaccharide that's extracted from red algae. I almost want to call it a vegetarian gelatin, which is also what gelin gum is, but we're going to get to gelin gum in a few moments. There are a few distinct types of carrageenan that are different in their properties, and it's important to make this distinction because the carrageenan used in foods, for the most part, is undegraded carrageenan, because that's what's approved for use in food products, while degraded carrageenan is not. Now, we're going to call the undegraded carrageenan food-grade carrageenan. It's not been shown to cause things like cancer. It's not listed as a carcinogen. However, many studies that have looked at carrageenan were done with the not food-grade carrageenan, but the degraded carrageenan, which really is not in our food supply at all. If it is, it's in less than 5% of our food supply, and it happens because of adulteration, not for any other reason. So, carrageenan, first approved for use in organics in the 1990s. Again, no nutritional value. It's for mouthfeel. Food technologists use it. But the Cornucopia Institute found, and what the Cornucopia Institute does, it protects the integrity of organics. And what they have found under closer scrutiny is that carrageenan, even the food grade, presents a host of problems, especially gastrointestinal inflammatory properties, including possibly higher rates of colon cancer. And now this has been seen mostly in laboratory animals. And I want to remind you, in those particular studies, the type of carrageenan used may be different than the food grade. So we're not quite certain. Cornucopia Institute has actually solicited personal accounts from individuals detailing what happens to their health when they remove carrageenan from the diet. And they've received over 1,200 testimonials that they're sharing with their researchers. And what they found is a lot of these individuals were experiencing inflammatory or irritable bowel disease and other gastric maladies. But when they learned of the impact of carrageenan and choosing to remove it, looking for it in labels and rejecting any products that contains carrageenan, what happened to many of these people is they reported an almost immediate relief. Cornucopia says within 22 to 72 hours and disappearance of their problems. Cornucopia is on top of this issue. They're still educating the public, dealing in their regulatory efforts on carrageenan use in the near future. Now, carrageenan is, for this reason, not just cornucopia, but other complaints that have been received from various agencies and individuals, has been removed in certain food products. And that's what Jean is writing about. In her Silk Soy Milk, it's not carrageenan anymore. It's gelin gum. And now, what is gelin gum? And this is another form of, I like to call, vegan gelatin. Now, gelin gum, it's a gelling agent produced through fermentation of an algae. So the source is the same. It's not necessarily the red algae, but it's coming from algae that carrageenan came from. Gelin gum is produced by fermentation, and it's used mainly in the food industry as an anti-settling agent, a thickener, a stabilizer to add structure to prepared foods, very much in the way carrageenan is or was used. And in very small doses, it works quite well, adding only a very light viscosity, which is desired in food technology. And for example, the uniform distribution of cocoa in chocolate milk can be helped by gelin gum. Okay, it doesn't alter the taste of foods to which it's added, and gelin gum's resistance to heat allows processed food to better support temperature changes during storage, during transportation. And the foods that are most likely to contain gelin gum, besides the soy milk, are baked goods, cake icings, various sweets, spreads, jellies, jams, puddings, sauces, and many dairy products or foods that are ready for the microwave. Gelin gum is also used as a substitute for starch or modified food starch in prepared food products. And I'm telling you about this from the molecularGastronomyNetwork.com, which is a very wonderful resource. Gelin gum also offers good moisture retention or water activity, and that helps with things like pie fillings. And it's less likely to keep it within the filling itself and not to wet the crust, which is very, very interesting. So for cooking application, gelling agent, gelin gum can be used for jellies and a multitude of dishes requiring jelly, such as terrines or even aspics. Okay, aspic is like a jello, if you can visualize what I'm talking about, but it's more a meat base. If you simmer bone broth, if you're making bone broth and you're simmering it forever and ever and ever and hours and you cool it off, it becomes a little kind of rubbery. It becomes much more thick and kind of wobbles, shivers like a jello. That's an aspic. So what else do we know about gelin gum? It's branded by a few suppliers as Gelrite, Nanogel, TC, Grove Gel, Applied Gel, or Phytogel. And as a gelling agent, it's used as an alternative to agar in microbial culture, and it's used in soy milks to keep the soy suspended in milk and adding no flavor. Gelin gum is similar to other gums like xanthan gum. You've heard of xanthan gum, which happens to be gluten-free. because it's a polysaccharide that's produced by bacterial fermentation. And gelin gum acts as a bulking agent similar to xanthan gum. No adverse effects have been reported really with gelin gum. However, a rat study with gelin gum supplemented at 5% of the diet for 4 weeks resulted in abnormalities of the intestinal microvilli, which we have to be concerned about. So the advice is those with sensitive guts, GI issues, should probably avoid gelin gum to be on the safe side. This is actually being suggested by many practitioners. I'm also reading the site of Dr. Jill Carnahan, who says gelin gum is a polysaccharide produced by Pseudomonas, and often people with sensitive immune systems react to these, you want to proceed with caution. All right. So the conclusion is gelin gum is often a replacement for carrageenan, which has been found to be problematic, but in and of itself, gelin gum may still be problematic. All right. Jean, thank you for that question. I hope my answer wasn't too long and too scientific, but I appreciate your question. I've got another question from Patricia. She writes, how much of D-mannose should I take each day? I take 3 to 4 teaspoons twice a day, but I find that it's very expensive. I've had a history of urinary tract infection. I currently take an antibiotic. I take 2 cranberry extract 500 milligram tablets per day and a probiotic. The D-mannose alone did not work. The antibiotic alone did not work, and cranberry extract alone did not work. Patricia, thank you for your question. First, let me tell you about D-mannose. D-mannose is a naturally occurring simple sugar closely related to glucose. D-mannose is actually made in small amounts in our bodies, and it can help to maintain a healthy urinary tract. D-mannose is helpful in preventing urinary tract infection because it interferes with the bacteria found in bladder infections, which is Escherichia coli, E. coli. Okay? This is a normal E. coli that's found as part of our normal microflora in the bowel, in the intestinal tract. But this E. coli does not belong in the bladder or the urinary tract. In these areas, they can multiply and become an undesirable infection. The cell walls of each E. coli are covered with tiny finger-like projections. And this is how they stick inside the walls of our bladders, in the urinary tract. And when we take a large quantity of D-mannose, which is indicated when you have an active infection, almost all of it spills into the urine through our kidneys. It literally coats any of the E. coli that's remaining, so it could no longer stick to the inside walls of the bladder and urinary tract. That way, then, the E. coli is rinsed away, if you will, with normal urination. The way to take the D-mannose, if you go to the drhoffman.com website and click on the store and type into the search engine D-mannose, M-A-N-N-O-S-E, this is what you'll get. A suggested use for adults is a half a level teaspoon with 6 ounces of pure water every 2 hours from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Day 2, half a level teaspoon with 6 ounces of pure water every 3 hours, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. And day 3, half a level teaspoon with 6 ounces pure water every 4 hours. And then what you could do thereafter is take a half a teaspoon maybe twice a day, mix in 6 ounces of pure water for maintenance. I find a lot of great results with my patients and clients who take D-mannose as a preventive thereafter, and they don't have urinary tract infection. Many women, even men, are prescribed antibiotics to kill to take care of urinary tract infections. But you know that antibiotics kill the bad bacteria, exactly what it's supposed to do, right? But it also kills the friendly microorganisms. And anyone taking antibiotics, if you're a woman, I know a few women who have never experienced a vaginal yeast infection, especially after taking a round of antibiotics. It's because a lot of this friendly bacteria is killed off along with the bad bacteria. That's how antibiotics work. Now, the long-term and often repeated antibiotic use for urinary tract infection can lead to more disruption in our microbiota, our microflora, and that could lead to major disruptions in our health, especially immune system function. And it's suspected that this E. coli of recent years that are mutants are caused by persistent antibiotic feeding to animals. In other words, those of you with persistent urinary tract infection that is cured only temporarily with a round of antibiotics and then requiring more and more antibiotics, say over the course of 6 months to a year, it could be because of our factory farmed animals, which are fed these antibiotics. And they're fed these antibiotics not necessarily to resist disease, but it's to fatten them up. It makes good economic sense for the farmer, unfortunately, to treat animals this way. But because of the antibiotic use, 60 to 70% of which is in agriculture, in our factory farmed animals, in our commercial meat, we're getting more resistant strains now of E. coli bacteria. And this is often presenting itself as recurrent UTI, urinary tract infection, particularly in women. A little scary, right? So another reason to go organic and grass-fed in your choice of your meat and your chicken, and especially chicken, where the antibiotic use is even more. Now, other common sense things to do about your UTI, ladies, it is best often, we have to remember our personal hygiene. You always want to wipe from front to back after urination and after a bowel movement. Because remember, that E. coli bacteria lives in the bowel. And if you're wiping the wrong way from back to front, that's how it finds its way to the urinary tract. And that can cause a bladder infection. It's also very helpful that before and after sexual intercourse, you void your bladder. Go pee before and after to help shed any remaining bacteria. Very, very important. But the addition of D-mannose is definitely helpful. And for Patricia, I would either up the dose of the D-mannose as described at drhoffman.com or check in again with your doctor to see if you have a resistant strain and maybe you need a different antibiotic. Okay? I thank you very, very much for your question. A little bit of good news about, well, not just a little bit. Aerobic exercise, we all know, is good for us. But according to an article in Medscape, they talk about a scientific research coming out of Barcelona that aerobic exercise has disease-modifying effects with mild cognitive impairment, MCI, mild cognitive impairment, and prediabetes. They find that now they have more evidence that aerobic exercise holds promise, I'm quoting, holds promise as a disease-modifying therapeutic intervention for adults in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease, which is very, very exciting. One of the hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease is high levels of a protein called tau, T-A-U. High protein levels of tau, high tau protein levels, rather, in the brain, are associated with progression to Alzheimer's disease. And in prior studies, they and others have shown that aerobic exercise has favorable effects on cognitive function and plasma levels of beta amyloid. Beta amyloid plaque is another hallmark of Alzheimer's disease. And it's the retention of that beta amyloid plaque which can lead to the progression of Alzheimer's. This particular study here's the study. 6 months of structured moderate to high intensity aerobic exercise also reduce the cerebrospinal fluid levels of tau protein, and especially in adults older than 70, and that's where we see most Alzheimer's is past the age of 70. Aerobic exercise was further associated with increases in blood flow in the brain, and that's also helpful with, you know, blood flow is good. Oxygen helped with executive function in thinking, critical thinking. And resting blood flow was increased in those areas of the brain where blood flow is typically decreased with aging and with the onset and progression of mild cognitive impairment due to Alzheimer's. So everybody, if you're not already, get on that exercise bandwagon. Make sure that you're doing your aerobic exercise as well as your strength training. Aerobic exercise is still very, very important. I thank you for joining me in this edition of Layla Weighs In on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. This is Layla Mutin, RD. I see patients every day here at the Hoffman Center. If you require a nutrition consult with me but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.